The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 156.
Interview with Michael R. Underwood.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest, obviously, is Michael Underwood. Welcome to the show again.
Hi, thanks for having me. This time I will be made of much more positivity.
Oh, well, good, because last time you hated Man of Steel so much that I almost put a hit out on you.
So. Well, I'm glad that you stayed that at least for a while, commuting the sentence.
For now. But I did need to make an announcement, and this is about Mike's health, and I mentioned this off podcast, I was going to do this, but I need you to turn in your geek card and have yourself committed immediately.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You have... there's too much geekery in one book. It's not... No. Like, you're gonna throw the alignment of the Earth out of whack. And you know, you and I both know this is what ended the dinosaurs, was just too much geekery. It was too many dinosaurs playing Nintendo and stuff like that. And we just can't have that. We got to make sure to, like... We got to rein it in a bit.
Now, the question is it too much geekery, or am I just providing an urban fantasy counterweight to the amazeballs super crazy geekery of Ready Player One, so that there can be balance in the nerdverse?
I'm going with the latter, Sean.
Touche, Underwood. I'm glaring at you from my computer, which you can't see, so that doesn't work. Anyways, but this is the two books you have here, which are Geekomancy and Celebromancy. And you really should read Geekomancy first, but I suppose you could read Celebromancy too first. It's kind of one of those things. But and they are what you just said. They're like urban fantasy geek sausages. They're just so packed full of geekery, but that all has a purpose, which is the weird thing, because it's not like you just going, like, oh, I'm going to talk about Batman, and then I'm going to talk about these old, like, Grant Morrison Animal Man comics. And no, it's they all have a purpose. And so the big question is, what the hell were you thinking when you first, like, decided, I'm going to write an urban fantasy in which all of the geeky stuff that geeks love is the centerpiece for the magic?
Well, for me, it all came from an idea that I had that tried to distract me from another novel that I was writing. In the fall of 2010, I was working on a novel which was called Codename Metaphysical Fencing Academy, which is a kind of it's in a setting where fencing is magic, because I'd study historical martial arts, and that was a whole bunch of fun. And then an idea came along into the green room of my brain being like, so, I'm awesome. You should write a book about geek magic in an urban fantasy setting. And I said, no, 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 no. I have a novel to write. I'm a serious novelist. I will finish this project first. And I was like, no, but seriously, I'm going to be an awesome idea. And during Thanksgiving break, I was hanging out with my girlfriend because she was in grad school. And therefore, for her, Thanksgiving break meant I will do all of the homework. So I gave myself the weekend to entertain this really silly, like, what if geek was magic kind of idea, inspired by things like Unknown Armies and Ready Player One and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Clerks, and just kind of taking a whole bunch of things that I loved and growing up working at a game store and living there, and kind of just tossed a whole bunch of it into my brain, hit blend, and started writing. And the character voice of Rhee, the lead, came out really quickly and really clearly to me. And I had so much fun writing that character and writing her kind of introduction to the world of geekomancy and kind of the secret subcultural style world of magicians in the city, that I had to set the other book aside. And geekomancy was originally called Distraction, the Novel. And then it took over as my main project, which seems to have gone pretty well.
Distraction, a Novel.
Yep. <That's>... I have weird code names for things.
That's awesome. Paul, you had a hand up, so that means you want to ask the next question.
Well, that hand was actually a test, but I can ask plenty of questions.
Okay, because I got bouncers off of what he just said. So, but
right. So you mentioned Unknown Armies as a role playing inspiration for geekomancy and celebromancy. What other role playing games did you put into that blender? I know you play role playing games. What other role playing games were fertilizer for your imagination, Michael?
I think probably the biggest other RPG influence would be Mage the Ascension from the old World of Darkness. And then aside from that, just kind of classic D&D, because it's been so foundational for the hobby. And in my experience, like my first tabletop role-playing experience, I was probably 8 or 9. And my classmates at school said, Mike, come play this thing. It's great. And then they had me roll up a barbarian character, and they gave me a dune buggy. And this was in Al-Kadim, which is not a setting that has, you know, locomotives or cars or dune buggies. But when you're 9 and you have your new friend make a barbarian character, like, what's awesome? Dune buggies are awesome. And that's kind of defined my relationship with tabletop RPGs. Like, a lot of things are dominated by the aesthetic of awesomeness. And, you know, I basically lived at a game store from the age of 13 through 18 when I got the job at that same store. And then I worked there all the way through undergrad. So, like, I've played almost every tabletop collectible card or miniatures game that came out during that chunk of time. So a lot of it just kind of all composted in. And sometimes I'm not even aware of what the next thing that's going to come bubbling out of my head when I'm trying to come up with the most appropriate reference for Rhee or another character to make as I'm writing the series.
That's awesome. I can see, given how well Rhee fits into that story, how you're basically channeling your own experience and pouring it into her and making her a part of that world.
Yeah, and I tried to have her interests diverge from mine in a couple of places, at least to a little bit. She's less of a lit SF&F person, just because I didn't want to get into the really weird meta place of spending lots of time talking about books written by people who are alive and I see at conventions.
Oh, like Jim C. Hines did, which I thought right. Which is an interesting contrast to yours.
Yeah, and I think the fun thing between Geekomancy and Libriomancer is if you want to, you can put it on the geek-nerd divide. If nerd is more academic and therefore associated with library, he covers that really excellently. And then I'm more on the pop culture geek side. But his lead also is a big SF&F fan. So I think the books are a nice kind of match to each other while having fairly different tone and a lot of different intents at different places. So I think there's room for both of us, which is very fun, especially since neither of us knew that the other one was writing also a book with a Mancy root based on love of pop culture.
I found that amusing. I see this book, I saw your book, and I saw his book, like, well, that's interesting. So I wound up reading both. and tend to read both sequels on both lines. Weird how stuff converges like that.
Yeah, there's my friend Marie Brennan, who you had on a while back. She refers to this as the volcano movie summer phenomenon, where she and Elizabeth Baer both had, like, I think Elizabethan fairy fantasies out in the same year with her with Marie's Midnight Never Come, and then Baer's, I think, the first of like Blood and Ink. I apologize if I get the title wrong. I haven't read it.
Yeah, Blood, Ink, and Hell on Earth. Yeah.
So that's it sometimes just happens. I think Jim and I were probably both reacting a little bit in our own ways to how extra super popular geekdom has become and the ways that a lot of people in geek cultures are reflecting on that. And we came up with two different ways of literalizing the metaphor of kind of the power of fandom.
And then it's really interesting too, like right as we're recording this, and this episode probably will go up after it's over, but Comic-Con is happening right now. And
would that I could be there.
I almost could have gone, but it's in the middle of the damn week and I work. So stupid. But what's interesting about that is that convention has become so large and so almost central to the industry that, I mean, it's almost sort of like, I don't know, it's like surpassed what E3 ever was, but in a totally different world. Because all of the TV people, all the TV and movie people go there. That's where they headline, like, bits and pieces of films that are coming out. And that's where they get some of their initial reactions from the intended fan base. And sometimes it doesn't go so well for them, but that's okay. Because I remember, what was that movie with, Babylon AD with Vin Diesel?
Oh, yeah.
You guys remember that movie?
Yeah.
I'm surprised anyone remembers that movie. But I remember that they like, play-tested parts of it or something at Comic-Con, and, like, the response was so lukewarm or just, like, confused as hell that they had to go back and, like, change the film. And then I think there was all sorts of arguments with the director and about cutting half the damn film out and all these kinds
right.
of... Yeah.
What I remember about it is that it ended up that the theatrical version was like edited within an inch of its life or possibly several inches beyond because people were so confused at like how the story hung together or in this case didn't. I don't know. Paul, did you see it?
I did not see it, unfortunately.
I don't think it's a terrible movie, but the theatrical version doesn't make a lot of sense, to be totally honest. There's okay. Yeah, I think I saw the theatrical version, and there's a lot of really interesting things, and I know there's like a 30-minute longer version, which I have not seen, but my understanding, at least at the time when I was interested in the film, is that those extra 30 minutes are all of the stuff that the director was pissed that had to be cut out. Because I don't remember if this is the movie where they took it, the movie away from him and like cut it on their own. I can't remember. Because that happened recently, like in the last like 5-6 years. Where the studio took the movie away from the director and like just cut right. it. Yeah. So, but I remember having really interesting elements, a kind of cyberpunky kind of elements, but
right, yeah.
the story just, there were like pieces missing where it was like, I don't know what the fuck just happened. So, but anyway, so Comic-Con's happening right now. And so there's lots of stuff. And if you're on Twitter right now, like every other tweet is Comic-Con tweets. So,
that's how
big it has become. It's like this monstrosity that follows us around.
It seems like it's mostly become an entertainment and media expo rather than kind of the big thing for the comic industry. I know that the New York Comic Con, which I went to last fall, which is the only Comic Con I've been to, you know, in terms of decreasing order of importance, it was like TV movies, then video games, then drop down a couple levels to comics, and then somewhere down towards the bottom is literature. And I don't know what exactly the balance is at San Diego, but it seems like, big Hollywood, the networks, and the big production companies have said, this is the place where we will, you know, do all the test screenings, and it's become the big nerd prom even more than it ever was, to the point now where I'm not sure how useful it would be for me to go as an author, because I'm not very high profile, and, you know, maybe in a few years I will be. Because it seems like some people, you know, they're big enough, like a John Scalzi or a Pat Rothfuss or, you know, Kevin Hearn, they're big, high profile enough that San Diego can be a great chance to meet, you know, 1,000 fans in a weekend. And, you know, it looks like they just, there was a big announcement just now that Name of the Wind has sold and been optioned for TV rights.
Yeah, I just saw that. Yeah, that's kind of cool.
So it's a, you know, very good place to make that kind of a big announcement. I think until I go, I won't really have a good sense on on what kind of it really does for literature. But even trying to register for it now is a complete nightmare. Like, in 3 milliseconds, the tickets go from being on sale to already sold out.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a lot of drama to even attempt to get to go there.
Yeah, and I find that just all of the horror stories people tell me of, like, waiting for 4 hours to go to an event, that for me would completely ruin the whole thing. Because, like, I'm not going to wait for 4 hours to see Neil Gaiman or like, Joss Whedon. Like, I love those guys, but I'm not waiting that long. Like, I got shit to do. So I'm going to go to the dealer's room and buy comics.
I feel like Comic-Con would probably be the most fun if you had a substantial posse. You're like, I and my 5 friends are going to go to Comic-Con, and if we have to spend most of the day in line, we'll spend the day in line talking to each other and being on Twitter and just kind of enjoying the experience in general. But yeah, I wonder if my time wouldn't be better served going to something like Worldcon or even DragonCon.
Yeah, because I feel like it's maybe a little bit more personal. So you would actually get a little bit more, like, we're thinking about these in terms of publicity, but you would get more face time with actual people, I would feel. So
yeah, and I think San Diego would probably be an amazing time to just go as a fan and as a lifelong fan and be like, oh my God, there's this, you know, here's a big, like, giant King He-Man statue, and look at all this cosplay, and just have the big fanboy time. But I can do that at New York Comic Con, which is a lot cheaper for me since I'm on the East Coast.
Yeah, same
one
here.
Day I will. One day I will make the pilgrimage to San Diego, and it will be awesome.
Yeah, I go to the International Conference on the Fantastic and the Arts, which is technically an academic conference, but it's also like a literary nerd fest.
Yeah,
because almost like the hundreds of SFF authors go to this thing. So,
yeah, actually, that was my first academic conference.
Oh.
I went back in, must have been 2005 or so, because in a previous life I was going to become a career academic and study, like, contemporary culture and SF. So I went to ICFA and presented several years running.
I'm in that process right now. I presented there twice, so.
Yeah, and it's really cool if you like SF and F Lit and you're in academia, because you get, you know, you get the academia that you can then get departmental support for, but you can also spend your time hanging out by the pool, you know, sipping fancy fruity drinks with big name authors.
Which I have done. It's a lot of fun. And a lot of people do get very, very drunk.
I've never heard of such a thing. We're all complete professionals, especially if you are one of Sean's, I don't know, deans or something, and you're listening.
Yeah, no. Like, half of the ICFA crowd is drunk by, like, 8 p.m. on Friday night, so. But I love them all, so it's okay. I'm sorry. We've totally diverged, so why don't we go back? We're going to go reel it all back in a bit, and actually jump back to the magic in your universe.
Mm-hmm.
Because we kind of talked very loosely about it at first, just kind of indicating that it's geek based, right? But one of the interesting things about your magic is it's not like when you look at the book on the surface, it seems like, oh, he's playing with it, you know, like your geeky thing makes the magic. But there's actually like a system here, which you kind of learn, and it's, I gotta admit, at first it's the most terrifying, horrible system a geek could imagine. Because some of that system requires destroying the item in question to take the powers from it,
yeah,
which hurts my soul. But then there are other things, like you could, like with films, you can watch films, and if there's a certain emotional attachment to anything, but like with a film, you can actually draw some of the power out. So Rhi, at one point, for example, when she first starts discovering her power, humorously enough, watches the new Sherlock from BBC. And starts getting that, like, where she looks at things and she sees words, you know, like, in the, when people watch the show, you know, you see the words pop up of all of the, like, details, and she basically, like, Sherlock analyzes her super, it's really interesting. So, like, this is, the system is based on, you know, kind of, experiencing, but also, on the other hand, destroying the things that you love to draw the power out to use for, in her case, she's using it to hunt down bad things, but I'm assuming also lots of bad people doing bad things with them too. So I was really curious, what kind of sick person are you that you would allow characters to destroy amazing pieces of geekery? No, I'm just teasing. That's so mean. but I guess kind of talking about, like, how would you go about kind of structuring this system? Because it is a system. It's not like just a bunch of stuff just kind of chucked together. There's a logic to it.
Yeah, I've gotten some reviews that are like, this magic system has no rules. And like, well, the way that I wanted to lay it out was that the main character starts not knowing the rules, and that we learn the rules as she learns them, and that the way that her mentor explains them is his understanding of the rules, just because geekomancy can't be that old, because people have not thought about themselves as geeks for terribly long, especially if you're comparing it to, I don't know, like alchemy as a magic system, which is, you know, hundreds of years of history or something. So what I wanted to do was build a system that showed different ways of engaging with material and with, like, artifacts, mm-hmm. and have some versions where it was very sustainable. And the way that the system ended up, as I put it together, I was very happy with it, because the most sustainable way of being a geekmancer is to invest directly in a character or a property or something. So the genre emulation has no deleterious effect to the stuff that's in the world. You watch The Matrix, you love The Matrix, and then you can do wire foo, or you can, you know, dial into a telephone, or you can upload a skill package. If you pick up a prop, it doesn't matter how much you love the prop. As long as you know what it does, you can use it for the thing. So somebody who totally hates Star Wars, but happens upon a Imperial blaster rifle from Star Wars Episode 4, can pick it up if they're a geekmancer and then use it to be a blaster, because it operates off with a nostalgia battery that's inherent to the thing, and it gets recharged by people all around the world thinking like, oh man, those blasters, you know, and the kind of collective unconscious affection for the materials and the story that they take part in.
Yeah,
like, that powers it.
This actually has a like, the more popular something is, an icon is, can actually detract. So, like, as you were saying, like, the blaster gets its power by the nostalgia people have for the blaster. But if there are, like, 10 billion blasters, all right. of that same nostalgic power is relayed across all of them. So, in fact, that the distribution of power becomes much less. So there's actually, like, this, like, downside to something being too popular.
Yeah, well, what that does is it kind of mirrors what I see as the hierarchy of props in terms of collectibles. So if you can find and acquire the one actual hero prop lightsaber from, you know, Return of the Jedi, that's Luke's lightsaber, and you have that one thing, you're going to have the most powerful version of Luke's lightsaber, because it is the one that has the strongest tie, because it's the most famous and the highest quality. Whereas if you go and pick up one of the little plastic extending lightsabers that you can get at Target for, I don't know, $20 or something, that's not going to have as much of a geekomantic charge. So that mirrors what I see as the hierarchy of merch, in terms of, you know, you walk into a fellow geek's you know, nerd cave, or, you know, room where they have all the cool, awesome collectibles, and you see, oh man, that's like a limited edition, custom-made lightsaber prop made by the people, you know, and that there's all this mythology around the really cool props and merch. So people like geekomancers in the world who are really malicious could hunt down and destroy or kind of monopolize the highest grade props, which for me is a mirror of the idea that if you collect in a way that keeps other people from being able to access something, that's not as being as good member of the community in my mind as collecting for yourself because you're excited and sharing that excitement. So that, you know, yeah, you can have people who you know, collect a whole bunch of stuff and hoard it away, but I'd rather collect a little bit and mostly focus on engaging directly with people as the way that I do kind of my geek existence, and therefore what I see as the most useful versions of geekomancy.
So you've constructed the magic system basically as a metaphor for your own engagement with geek culture.
Yeah, I don't think it could really have been anything other than a reflection of how I see the ways that kind of people perform geekdom in the world. I've now discovered that there's a scholar, his name's Jacob Brown, who actually presented on geekomancy at an undergrad conference at Bowling Green, which is really cool. And he cites the same subcultural scholars that I studied when I was in grad school. So I realized through what his presentation that I then read the essay of, that I had internalized and then reified some of the ideas from those scholars like Dick Hebdige and a couple of others into the system, so that there's subcultural theory which has then informed my understanding of how geek society works, and then has made its way back into prose by being in my fiction.
That's amazing.
When I saw that he was basically pinging me without knowing that he was citing the same people that I had been studying, that was very cool. On the one hand, it was like, oh no, I'm not being as original as I thought. On the other hand, it was, oh wait, like this means that I've actually been clear about taking the lead from this scholarship and then moving it forward by putting it into a fictional speculative frame, which basically means that I've become very happy because this series is basically what my doctoral thesis would have been, except in fiction, and I'm getting paid for it.
And more than 60 people are reading it.
Right. Several more than 60 people have read it, and that's all very fun. And it's a lot more fun to write than even writing my master's thesis was. And that was fun to write, but academic prose is nowhere near as fun as zingy, snappy, snarky dialogue and description.
Absolutely.
Hey, it's not very nice.
There are very good academic writers, but I feel like being an excellent academic writer is not praised as vociferously or as extensively as it ought to be. And it's definitely not a match of how elevated prose is praised in the fiction world. So if you can write well as a scholar, people will notice, but it's not necessarily going to get you the tenure or get you some huge endowment, maybe in the way that you'd get a literary award on the fiction side. But that's my perception, having been out of academia for a while.
Yeah, there's some truth to that. It has a lot to do with where you get published and who reads your book. And of course, since you're in academia, it means like 8 people read your book. Which, why am I in this field? No, I'm just teasing. Sorry. I was actually trying to search again, but I swear there was a reference to Hart and Negri in here.
Yes. So
I was right.
there is a Hart and Negri. So Ree's roommate is named Sandra Wilson, and her boyfriend is a grad student at Pearson University, the kind of city university in this made up town. And in the third chapter, they're out kind of drinking, and they're going to go get pizza later. And Ree references how Darren has to basically appease his doctoral board by referencing Hart and Negri as frequently as possible. Like, so I use that as my jibe at traditional academia, and a way to then also make in jokes for the academic crowd.
That's adorable. The weird thing is, I don't know how many people outside of academia would know who Hart and Negri are.
Yeah, maybe that was not the most accessible of references, but one of my friends who was in the writing group that I was in that helped me learn how to actually be an SF writer, which Marie was in back at Indiana University, and he was a huge Hart and Negri fan, so that reference was also a little bit of a shout out to him, because I have little bits and bobs throughout the series that are inspired very directly by one friend, because it's some pet project or property that they really love, and a way to include more perspectives than just mine in things. Like, I've read, I think, almost no Hart and Negri in terms of critical theory. You know, there may be a Judith Butler reference somewhere in the series already. If not, I'll add one at some point.
That's awesome.
No, because I love Buttermore. I actually, I presented at ICFA a paper that was, "Dear Feminist Critical Theory, Dear Science Fiction Fantasy, you are writing stuff that is relevant to one another. Why aren't you talking more?" So I talked about Octavia Butler and Judith Butler.
That's so awesome.
That sounds like a panel for WISCON.
Well, with Judith Butler, for sure, yeah.
I think it has been a panel at WISCON, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be again.
Yeah, well, absolutely. With someone like Butler, because of her concept of gender performativity.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So, Sean, you going to start coming to WISCON?
I may. I mean, I don't know if I can because of financial reasons, but I have completely changed my opinion of WISCON in the last, like, 3 years. I was before, like, one of those, I don't want to go there because I don't want to be angry all the time people. But now I'm like, I want to go there because I feel like I belong. Because I've become one of those, like, uber feminist guys, which is kind of, I guess, kind of cool.
Yeah, it, like ICFA, has a full academic panel track.
Yeah.
So you can get, like, the checkbox from your university for going and presenting.
Which is an option. Although I'm not a feminist theorist. I don't really know enough about feminist theory. I mean, I know some, but I don't feel comfortable writing about it at times.
I think if you have a paper on kind of geek/SF culture, you probably can sneak in. Just go and look at the schedule over the last couple of years. They should have, like, actual short abstracts from all of those presentations. Mm. And see if there's something you're interested in that would kind of fit within that realm. Or just come to WISCON because it's pretty awesome.
I want to go. So if I can afford to go one day, I will go.
All right, let me know. For the moment, I think I'm going to be alternating between it and Balticon because they're always the same weekend. And not going to Balticon when I live in Baltimore is kind of silly. So I should go at least once.
Fair enough. Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of feminism, since this is actually related to your book, your main character's, I think it's fairly obvious, but anyone listening, is a woman. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that based in her the particular context in which she exists, she would be considered what some people mean when they say a strong woman. I still don't exactly know what that means, but I'm just going to go with it for now. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about her is that her character is very much embedded in this kind of geek world, not just because she is a geek herself, but that we have this perspective of the kind of the social culture of how women grow up in a geek world and kind of mature and become adults. And, you know, they deal with the dating stuff and they deal with the, you know, getting a job and doing all that shit that everybody has to do, that kind of thing. And I was really curious, what was your impetus for writing a female character? Because you can write a male character, a female character, doesn't matter either way, but there's always kind of a reason you'd select the direction you go. And then what was the process in developing her as a person?
Yeah, when I was mulling through the idea of doing a book around geek magic, I was thinking about depictions of geeks that I've seen in popular media. So I'm thinking about Chuck. I'm thinking about Big Bang Theory. I'm thinking about Breaking In. I'm thinking about Community. And almost all of those, and especially the like one episode versions where like NCIS, where they go to Comic-Con, or, you know, the procedural shows where there's the one nerd episode, I found that it was almost always a male geek, and within that, very frequently, if not also almost always, a white geek. So the straight white male geek is kind of the narrative default, just because of, you know, patriarchy and hierarchy. That's the perceived human default. But I know that you know that's not the reality in the world. And not in the world of geeks. And because I am a straight white guy, it would be easier for me to write a straight white guy, and I wanted to give myself a challenge. And I wanted to have a lead who was emblematic of a version of geekdom that I hadn't seen properly or sufficiently represented in media. I wanted to have a female geek. I wanted to have a geek of color. I wanted to have a queer or a quilt bag geek. Like, there's fighting over what term set you want to use, and I want to not offend anyone. But, you know, the character is bisexual, because I wanted to, it's like, okay, if I take those character elements, then here are some identity facets. I'm going to combine those with a geeky character. And then I thought about kind of her backstory. So she's biracial, and her dad was an ex-Marine, and her mom then vanished when Rhee was a teenager. And I kind of put all these together, and that they form the skeleton of the character. And then I got to fill her up with a lot of the same kind of fandoms that I have, but then also give her really notable characteristics that are a contrast to me in other ways. Like, she's way more impulsive than I am, and she tends not to be as kind of emotionally analytical. And, you know, she's super loyal to her friends, which is something that I try to be. So I was fairly deliberate in assembling a cluster of characteristics, which would then let her be as close to a fully realized person as I could. And then the way that I wrote the book was to know Rhee as best as I could as a character, and then just apply her worldview as my frame into seeing the world. So that as I'm writing, I'm thinking, what would Rhee say about this? You know, take my knowledge, put it through her perspective, and it comes out as Mike's knowledge plus Rhee's snark plus the kind of comedic voice of the book, and then that's how I got going. And it worked out to be pretty effective. From my perspective, you know, it was easier to write than maybe if I were just writing a character who was effectively me. Having enough difference made it easier to put the character into that world and let them have their own momentum.
We've been stunned into silence by your brilliance.
All right, I'm gonna put a little hash mark on my board here. If I get to 3, I get a prize, right?
No. We didn't agree to no prizes. What are you talking about?
Well, first you try to take away my geek card. I can't innovate or be spontaneous at all.
No, I never said you can't be spontaneous. I said there's just a limit.
Oh.
You know, the overfill problem.
Right.
The books are just filled with awesome.
Right. If you go too far over, you ruin the Earth's orbit and you plummet us all to death.
No, but then I can use the excess super nerdery to fly against the spin of the Earth and turn back time before there's a critical mass of nerdery. That, or we just export the nerdery into parallel dimensions.
Okay.
That actually leads into a serious question I had.
Yes, I want to hear this.
I had a question about the world building, Mr. Underwood. I got the feeling when reading Geekomancy, especially given a certain character and what you've told me about that character, that the universe of Geekomancy and Celebromancy is a lot larger than the Earth. I was curious, what are its underpinnings and how did you develop it?
Right. So most of that comes from the fact that I wanted to use Drake Winters as a character. And Drake actually started as a character concept for Changeling the Lost, which is the new World of Darkness Changeling RPG. Mm-hmm. And all the characters in Changeling the Lost are survivors with a capital S. And I had seen someone like on RPGNet, I think, talk about how cool of a keeper, like the fairy people who steal humans away and then hold them prisoner and transform them, how cool of a keeper would the Doctor be? And I said, oh, that's a cool, twisted way of looking at the Doctor Who universe. So I came up with this guy who was, you know, steampunk adventurer with Bolt. And Mary Robinette Cole, who does the audiobook, does a great Drake Winters voice. That's better than the one I can do because she can do the accents. But I wanted that character who's like made of adventure, and then have him be the companion for a Doctor Who-esque character. But I was like, okay, well, flip the gender. So it's the Contessa of the Lapis Galleon is my Doctor Who stand-in character, and then Drake is her companion. and they go and have amazing adventures across kind of the realms of deep fairy, which are more stuff that I stole from like the exalted version of fairy with the raksha and everything.
Yep.
And kind of mush it into the deep dreaming from original Changeling and kind of smush things around. And it's like, okay, well then he gets just unceremoniously dumped somewhere like the Doctor's companions do. What if he gets dumped in a universe that's not his? So like he comes from a different timeline / universe than the one that he ends up in. And I used him in one place and I used him in another place. And then as I was writing, I got to the scene at Grognard's and I'm like, wait, how awesome would it be to have Drake Winters in this universe? He's an equally ridiculous being to fit and not fit my ridiculous nerdy world. And that character has turned out to be a great foil for Rhee because they get along in a lot of ways, but are, you know, one of them is thoroughly modern and made of kind of breezy pop culture, and the other is kind of square-jawed, good-natured, but completely out of his element kind of guy. And he makes a great straight man for all of Rhee's zingers.
he's really, one of my favorite characters, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Basically, because I wanted to have Drake in Rhee's world, I had to figure out how his cosmology fit into that of this world. And then when I came up with the pun of the thrice retcon Duke of Pwn, one of the Dork Lords of Hell, I'm like, okay, well, there's some of the rest of my cosmology. And that was designed far enough in advance, kind of as I was breaking out the beats of the overall novel, that I got to make the rest of the world kind of make sense. And the first draft, I didn't have to worry about things too terribly much because, like I said, Rhee didn't understand what things were like. And Eastwood has a very particular point of view. So you get to the end of the book and you have the chance to reconsider some of the things that he's said because, like anybody, he's just human. So he has a limited understanding of things. So that it meant that there was some room in the cosmology to be able to play fast and loose in the first draft and then go back and say, okay, how does this all fit together? And I still have left what I feel is some room to add other things. You know, in the second book, I added celebromancy. There's a couple of other mancies that I'm going to add if the series gets to continue more.
Furry mancy.
Oh God, Sean, don't do that.
It's... Now let's be fair. The precise term is atavism, because I didn't want to like furries are fun to make fun of, but they don't do anything bad to anybody. So I didn't want to have all the mentions of furries in the book or the series be like just pot shots. So instead I wanted to create something where there was a denigration kind of within a certain subsection of the magical culture. But then for the people who are doing it themselves, it's another way of connecting with something that you're passionate about, which has become a central theme for all the magic styles that I'm creating in this world. Which, you know, it borrows from some other fantasy series where, you know, magic is about will and passion, you know, magic as the cheat codes of the universe to steal from Planetary, because if I can steal from Planetary whenever possible, I will, because it's amazing. So yeah, that's the universe. It's kind of weird and doesn't make sense, but hopefully it fails to make sense in a coherent way, in the way that our universe kind of fails to make sense.
That's a very unknown army sort of point of view.
Yeah, I think... I didn't want to be as grim as Unknown Armies, but I really am fond of the humanism in Unknown Armies, where people, just people, are really the big agents in the universe. I have other monsters and stuff, but I wanted to keep some of that while being a bit more kind of happy bouncy than the grimdark of Unknown Armies. Unknown Armies was very 90s, and I didn't want to be that like that.
Sorry, I got stuck on the furries. No, it's actually, it was because there are many different types, that we've kind of already mentioned this, there's so many different types of magic. And so, like, geekomancy is the primary magic system that's being explored, I think, in the book of the same title. Duh. Yeah. And obviously then celebromancy is a different kind of magic, but, you know, in geekomancy we first learn about what is, the official term is atavism, but... The kind of, I guess, the mocking term would be furrymancy. And it's actually an interesting system, I thought, because on the one hand, like, it's you can make fun of it as being part of like that furry world, and a lot of people don't get that world. I don't quite get it, but you know, but people make fun of it because it seems silly, but don't get it. But there is this almost like a spiritual side to it, because these, as atavists, they actually are attached to like almost, I don't remember the exact term you used, like a spirit animal, but like they have like an animal attachment, and the more closer that they bring themselves to that creature, whatever it is, the more they actually draw from it.
Yeah, I think the term I use for Eastwood's explanation was primal spirit.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a way to reverse engineer from furrymancy, because that's a funny joke, into something that seems like it would be coherent in the universe. Mm-hmm. And also a way to get to lycanthropes that I hadn't seen done before. Just because there's the comedic element in, but it's, you know, it's not an infection thing. It's not a race of beings who, you know, have evolved alongside humanity. It's, okay, well, this is a magic system where people, they choose the path themselves. You know, having either found a way to make a connection to the primal spirit or being born with the connection. So it was a way to approach a familiar trope in what I hope was a fresh and distinct way. And mostly it was like, oh, wait, dude in a fursuit attacks Rhee because this would be a great time for her to be totally overawed by something. And this is, you know, a weird, funny thing. And then I have that character that I can bring back at some point. And I wanted to lay some seeds in Geekomancy that I could then harvest later on, because, you know, I wrote the book and then I started doing revisions, and then somebody offered me money for it. So I was early on in the process when I sold it, which gave me the opportunity to go, well, there's going to be at least one more book. Let me do some work now to give myself opportunities later on down the road. And kind of developing atavism was one of the things that I did to give myself something fun to play with later.
Hmm. And you do a lot of this, actually, where you draw in, you know, mythologies and narratives that we're familiar with. So like there's in relation to the atavism, you actually talk in quite a bit of length about vampires and the kinds of histories of vampires. And I think there's this amusing moment where the Eastwood says, like, all the vampires used to be like the Dracula types, but then they like something happened to them, and then they become like these weirdos who like prey on teenagers. I think it was like something along those lines, and there's, you know, and obviously there's, you know, there's making fun of the sparkling vampires, because of course you have to. And I think Eastwood actually calls the books the Mormon vampire books.
Yeah, because I didn't want to name specifically, because one, I don't want to make fun. I don't want the book to feel like I'm making fun of Mormonism, because I don't know, I have Mormon friends, and there's nothing in Mormonism, in my experience of like people who are practicing now, that's particularly mockworthy. But what I wanted to do was isolate the discussion around those books and take some jokes at that, because Stephanie Meyer has all of the money. And therefore, if I make fun of her cultural property, I'm not punching down, because she has all of the money and all of the literary success. You know, she never has to write any other books in the world. And, you know, 50 years from now, her books will probably still be talked about because of how much of a phenomenon they were. But what that let me do is say, okay, well, there's this, if I use the idea of the collective unconscious, which I think connects really well with the system of Geekomancy, where individual kind of affect and passion for stories has a lot of power. If that works kind of on a cosmological level, then what would have happened, assuming that vampires are subject to this, what happens when you have a sea change in how vampires are thought about? When you change from Bram Stoker's Dracula, when you change from regional and national folkloric ideas of creatures that we now call vampires across the world, into Bram Stoker's Dracula, into the later Gothic, into kind of the Hammer era, into the Anne Rice era, and now into the Twilight era, that became a fun progression in my mind that I wanted to play a little bit, and then it gave me the chance to make a joke, and then something I was happy with, get to the possibility that Stephanie Meyer, if in this universe she is aware of all this, could actually be a gigantic hero, because she's creating vampires that are fairly powerful, but they're also so mock-worthy that, you know, entire cities are being cleansed of them by powerful hunters. So that, you know, could be that Stephenie Meyer is responsible for making vampires go extinct, which then I hadn't realized that I'd kind of done that a sideways reference, but it's a little bit like how the Dresden Files treats the Black Court vampires with Bram Stoker's Dracula. And the idea of fiction becoming a huge weapon in the kind of the metaphysical war against the supernatural, which then also loops back around to Libermancer. It's like we all read each other's stuff or live in the same culture.
As if.
I like how Stephenie Meyer became a potential committer of genocide.
Right, because depending on how you look at it, she's either, you know, an incredible hero to the super, you know, to the world by creating the opportunity to eliminate or, you know, entire swaths of vampire nests because they've been reimagined into less super nasty versions, or she's a horrendous person who is, you know, destroying centuries of vampire cultural heritage, and it's completely unclear as to what is the reality.
Yeah, and that actually goes to one of the, like, when Reeve first kind of discovers this world through Eastwood, and Eastwood tries to explain to her how all of the magic stuff came together, and he doesn't have the exact answers. He basically tells her, either we created these things because of the way we imagined them in our various forms of literature, and that's just the compounding of it eventually created, that somehow literature itself or making narratives itself creates it, or somehow those things existed and our literature is amplifying it.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting.
Cool. Yeah, I wanted to go kind of back to the Buffy and the first and the origins of the Slayer and play with kind of primordial storytelling as world building and do something that was my own, but then also indicated what I think is appropriate, that being a cosmology that's not perfectly clear. You know, in a world where we have gamers who grow up reading deities and demigods and knowing every single little bit about the cosmology of the fictional worlds that they play in, you know, the world that we live in, we have tons of competing religions and lots of people think that they have the answer and lots of other people say, we have no idea what the answer is. Having a ambiguous cosmology gives me the opportunity to play with a lot of things. And then to let characters be wrong, where Eastwood admits that he doesn't know everything, and then when he does talk about things confidently, it gives Ree the opportunity to maybe doubt that he is completely correct about things. And it means that everybody's relative truths can be competing without me having to say things, you know, this is exactly how things are. And that as long as I try to be internally consistent and lampshade when people are saying things, but we can't necessarily trust them to be objectively correct. It lets me show the world being pretty messy, which is fun to play in then and as a storyteller.
Sorry, I had to cough there. Paul, did you want to? I didn't know if Paul wanted to jump in. No.
Well, yes, I will jump in. It sounds like, at least from an external reader looking into the book's point of view, that it's the trope of all myths are true or all myths are potentially true. How much is it, how firm is it in your brain, Michael, as far as what the real truth of what's going on?
I think that the all myths are true trope, which I ping as also being on TV Tropes, is my baseline framework. That there are chunks of the universe that I haven't spent the time to think through because I haven't had to yet. And I want to have the chance to be excited and have the kind of sense of discovery as I do more world building and moving on in the series. You know, as I move on, I need to make sure that I'm not directly contradicting anything I've established before, but I feel like I built things up enough in the first book and now kind of following my own rules while expanding the universe in Celebromancy, that if something comes along and it's like, that would be amazing, but it directly contradicts something I've established already, I either have to go, well, that's too bad, use it somewhere else, or I have to figure out, is there a reason why in the universe the rules would change? Because I've established that the rules of the universe can change, which gives me some flexibility. I definitely haven't mapped out the whole universe in terms of like creating a setting Bible. I've done more work like that for other projects, but since this is an urban fantasy series, you know, I spend my world building effort a lot on the magic systems and knowing enough about the overall cosmology that that I'm being pretty consistent. I like Brandon Sanderson's ideas of like his rules of magic for him. I don't fully use them for myself in terms of like the audience's understanding of magic is directly proportional to the author's ability to get away with using magic to solve problems, is my paraphrase of that first rule. I think that there is more room for grayness, especially if I put it in terms of cultural relativity, where you have characters in the story and then who don't know everything about how the rules of the universe work, which then means that the readers don't know everything about how the rules of the universe work, which some people have reacted negatively to because, you know, I have tons of D&D references, and in D&D, it's a known universe with moral absolutism. You know, you have detect evil, and if you have smite evil, and you go, I've detected that this is evil, and I have a smite evil power, I will kill this thing without any compunctions, and because I'm a lawful good paladin, I will sleep soundly at night. You know, and that's actually something that you can ding D&D on, because that moral absolutism really is directly oppositional to cultural relativism, and that's getting into anthropology and folklore grad school, which is a very different form of highfalutin thinking than Paul's initial question. So digression point, Mike.
I have a slightly different question. I'm going to earn my keep here, Sean, and go into a slightly different topic. So we would be remiss if we didn't mention or point out that you also work for Angry Robot. How has your position in Angry Robot made you a better author?
So my title at Angry Robot is North American Sales and Marketing Manager. And what that means kind of on the day is that I'm the only staff member for the fiction division, which is Angry Robot, Strange Chemistry, and Exhibit A, who works in North America. And we have Random House as our distribution partners, which is awesome because they have, you know, great access and lots of muscle as a sales and distribution team. What I do is I manage the Random House team, and the biggest thing that is useful from my authorial background and then to my writing is working with authors. So I, you know, help coordinate meetings and marketing plans and positioning and strategy for Angry Robot books. I read into the acquisitions meetings, and I give my votes on whether a book that one of the editors wants to buy is something that will work in the North American market. And then now I'm getting to the point where books that I voted on are coming out, and I'm seeing, was I right? Is there room for this in the market? What are the factors? And what this job has given me is a lot more data and experience looking at the science fiction publishing industry on a really kind of high level. And it's let me look at Mike the author from the perspective of Mike the marketing and sales guy, which means that I'm getting to be more refined in my ability to talk about my work in terms of market, in terms of ideal reader, in terms of, you know, where it fits within the genre, what marketing strategies are going to be more or less useful based on what's happening in ebook sales, or, you know, okay, well, this like mass market is suffering in Barnes & Noble, so not having a mass market for this urban fantasy series and focusing on ebook is fine because here are these venues. And like, I can think on that level, which I really would not have been able to think effectively if I weren't working in publishing, which gives me a big hand up there. And then that feeds back in from being an author to being an Angry Robot. When one of our authors is like, I'm freaking out about this thing, and I can say, I have had that freak out. It will be okay. Here's what I did when I had that freak out.
Booze. And it,
yeah, sometimes it is. Sometimes it can be that. But sometimes I've found it's just having someone say, you know, I've been there. You can get through it. This is very natural. So I find that the Angry Robot job and being a writer really feed into each other very effectively. And my colleagues at Angry Robot have been tremendously supportive of my writing. So I think there's a great synergy and symbiosis between the two, which I hope will continue on for a while. And it's great because I get to meet all of these authors who then become not only professional colleagues, but some of them become, you know, individual personal friends. So it's a very happy place to be, and it seems to be benefiting both sides.
That's awesome.
That is quite awesome. Yeah, and it gives you an insight, and I like that you could do a job that I could actually give you an insight into the life of a writer. Because I guess, you know, there's still the problem where, you know, young writers don't realize, you know, that writing isn't just like becoming a published author isn't just about getting a book published. There's a whole universe outside of that, you know, learning how to, you know, market yourself and you know, be involved, because like it's really difficult to be Thomas Pynchon in this world. I mean, it's not difficult for him. He's doing fine. Like, he could write a book about, you know, evil ponies and he'd sell like a million copies. But it's difficult for anyone else to become someone like that, where they can be withdrawn from the world, because that's not how the market really works anymore. I mean, if you're not interacting, it's much more difficult for people to see your name, because they won't see it in search terms and things like that. So,
yeah, and it's given me the ability to, and now we'll switch back into super geek mode, be able to think about myself and the authors that I work with in terms of their strengths and their kind of weaknesses or areas that they focus on less. Like, this author in this book has, you know, this level of prose style that's, you know, intentional, beautiful, deliberate language, and they pacing here, but then also authors have, like, how good are they speaking in person? How good are they marketing on, you know, marketing online? Do they manage merch? Do they do that well? Are they responsive to their editor, to their, you know, their marketing manager, and just getting a broader view of what it means to be an author in every different way. And knowing as the sales manager what I hope for from authors who work with me, and then trying to emulate those best practices when I have my author hat on, so that I'm a better asset to my publisher at Pocket.
Well, excellent. So this is very informative to kind of get that different perspective. So, cool.
You know, any time you want, I will happily talk your ear off about the synergy between those. Timothy Ward did a 2-part interview with me that we talked a fair bit about that, and that was very fun. I find it's something I have that's fairly distinct to me as an author, which means I feel comfortable talking at length about it whenever anyone is interested.
And Ward just took over Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago, a month and a half maybe.
I think it's just over a month now as of this recording. So congrats, Tim.
Yeah, he's got big shoes to fill, and so it's, you know, it takes a time to get into the rhythm. So yeah, I'm subscribed, so I know that he's on the show. And
okay,
yeah. Sorry, that was completely useless information for everybody.
Inside baseball.
So really quick, you have the two books out. You have Geekomancy and Celebromancy. So those are out now. People can go buy them. They can get them at your website, which is what?
MichaelRUnderwood.com.
Excellent. And what can folks expect to see from you, you know, in the relatively near future? I mean, do you have any short stories coming out? Are you going to be appearing anywhere? That kind of thing. New book, maybe, perhaps, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'll be at Worldcon in San Antonio. And then I'm going to be at BoucherCon, which is a mystery convention for anybody who's a mystery reader. That's in September. World Fantasy at the end of October in Brighton. And my next big publication is very likely to be the third Re-Reyes story, which is currently titled Fortress Grognard. And it's a shorter work. It's going to probably end up being 30 to 45,000 words, depending on what kind of extensive cuts my editor asks for and how much more he asks back. And then I have a new series that's also urban fantasy with Pocket, but the first one of that probably won't come out until next fall.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I laugh because I get what the title means, because I've read the book. So, And I won't ruin that. People should read the book so they will know who that is.
Absolutely.
Yep. So, okay, so we know your website. You've got, you're going to be at WorldCon, which is probably that's the first thing you're going to be at coming up soon, mm-hmm. which means I'm going to see you. And I will cower in the corner before your greatness, so.
Oh, no, come on. I didn't cower when I met Michael, and neither will you.
I know. Well, I won't.
We can sidle up to the bar, roll D20s, and that will decide who has to pay for drinks.
I have a D20.
Is it a fair D20, or is it
a cheat?
What's the technical term? I was gonna say voted? Magic. I was gonna use magic.
No, I don't have one of those. I have a regular D20. I also have a D4, which are weird as hell to roll, by the way.
Also known as gamer caltrops.
Well played.
That's not a term I invented. I give that back to the geek universe.
Yeah, they hurt like hell to step on.
Especially the old ones where you would like put the wax onto them, like because the edges aren't rounded. It's like actually sharp.
It hurts. Yes. I've stepped on them a few times because I'm a stupid idiot and would leave them on the floor. So, wouldn't recommend it. So cool. So everybody should go check out the books. We'll make sure there's links up. They're at Pocket Books, which is through Simon & Schuster, if I've got that right. You can go to his website, michaelrunderwood.com. Get his books there. There'll be a link to that, too, just in case you all forget, which you shouldn't forget because you're going to go buy the books or else I'm going to hurt Paul. So,
no.
What?
For every person who doesn't buy the books and listens to this show, I will hurt Paul.
I'd like to state I don't support this blackmail, but you should buy the books anyway.
So thank you, Michael, for joining us for the interview. You're also going to appear with us before this episode goes up for Pacific Rim. So this is going to be like one of those weird time travel-y moments.
It's an order of operations thing, like last in, first out. It's like instants and magic and interrupts.
There you go. Exactly. So you're going to be an interrupt?
I think he's talking magic card stuff.
Oh, no, I know. Right, magic the Gathering. I get it.
Yeah, like the WISB will be the interrupt, which will show up. It's on the top of the stack of Skiffy and Fanti. So it will show up in the feed first. Yes!
That's awesome. Cool. Well, thank you, Michael, for joining us for the interview and talking about your books and your geeky life.
Thanks for having me. It's great chatting with you guys.
Cool. And we'll be back whenever we come back.
Good night.
Bye. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanti@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanti.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanti.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanti Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.